Thank you very much for giving up your lunch to come and listen to Historical Scotland. I should say from the outset, as the title page suggests, that this is a multi-authored presentation. Alice Reed, who I work with and have done so for many years in Cambridge, and Lee Williamson and Chris Dibben, who 2 months ago were at the University of St Andrews and are now at the University of Edinburgh. So it's a bit of a patchwork, and I'm keeping my fingers crossed that you can't see the joins, but I do apologise if the joins show and if I don't represent my co-author's work, and if I make rude remarks about Alice's graphics, which I suspect I will. The topic of the talk is mortality in Scotland from 1855 to 1949. And what I'd like to talk about, first of all, is how deaths from the person dropping dead to the statistics on the page that we work with join up and come about. So I would like to look at reporting of deaths at the local level, and then looking at how the Registrar General reports the statistics about cause of death at the national level. Having discussed those things, we'll then move on to look at patterns of mortality in Scotland over time and with age. We could do geography, but we're not going to do that today. And then I'm going to finish off, hopefully, with some thoughts on some of the well-established theories that people who work in historical demography and modern-day demography chew over from time to time. Omron's theory about the epidemiological transition, and McEwen's theory of how mortality is related to improving standards of living. We shall see that Scotland doesn't fit well into either of these categories, those theories. Now, when we're obviously teaching people who know much better than me the difficulties of dealing with causes of death over time or space, comparing either 19th century with 20th century, or France with England, or Botswana with England, or wherever, you have to consider problems of consistency and their continuity in how doctors are diagnosing what is killing people, how those causes of death are being reported, not necessarily by the doctors, it could be being reported by lay people, they could be being reported in surveys, and then the classifications that the authorities, in this case the Registrar General for Scotland, are applying to the causes of death to squash them down into usable statistical categories. And I'm going to discuss two sources that we've been using to study these issues. First of all, at the top there you can see a typical Scottish death certificate. It's slightly atypical in that it's the death of a doctor. His name's Alexander Campbell, says he's a medical doctor, gives all his degrees. It tells you that he died in January in 1888, and it tells you that he died of epilepsy. And then it says who certified the death, gives you his parents' names, it tells you he died when he was 57, and then it tells you such things as who registered the death and what the relationship to the deceased was. So those are that's the kind of information we have. It varies over time in that in Alexander Campbell's case we only have one word: he died of epilepsy. We know nothing else about his death, we just know he died of epilepsy. In later years we might have had several categories, up to three or even four categories of related to the event that killed him. And that in itself causes us issues. Which of those varied causes was actually put into the statistical database by GROS? And the second set of data that we're going to look at is the Registrar General for Scotland's annual reports. And we're going to use Ronald Davenport's data set, which she may have discussed when she came to give a talk earlier in the term, which lists all the causes of death by age and sex for the whole of Scotland for each year from 1855 to 1949. And it meets very neatly with the World Mortality Database, which starts in 1950 and carries right up to the present day. So you can potentially now map causes of death for Scotland and England and Wales, which Romola's database also includes, in the case of England and Wales, from 1837 right up to 2010, 2011, and for Scotland from 1855 through to 2010, 2011. And why was I interested in this? Alice and I were interested in these. We were trying to compare urban and rural mortality. And in the case of Scotland, we have urban and rural mortality differences from the GROS reports. And you can see here that it actually mentions the detailed annual report. Scotland is different, slightly different from England in that it has an annual report, which is quite general, and then it gives a detailed annual report, and it reports causes of death by small geographical areas and geographical regions. The GROS, the Registrar General, I suspect, was very aware that Scotland was very diverse. It has very urban areas, Glasgow, Edinburgh, and incredibly rural areas, very remote, and he was aware and interested in the differences in the demography, both the births and the deaths, of this diverse range of areas that Scotland possessed. So he reports deaths for the principal cities. They start off with 8 of those, and then he gradually decides that some of them are getting a bit bigger, so you'll have, by the end of the period as shown on the graph, which is the 1910, he has 15 principal towns. They're not even, we couldn't really call them cities. He then looks at large towns, small towns, which I suspect in England would probably be villages, and then he looks at rural areas. Down here we have rural areas divided into insular rural and mainland rural. This is a theme that goes through all of the Registrar General's reports, is that the islands were very different, he argued in many ways, from the mainland rural areas. Although they didn't look so different when we compare their death rates. These are the rural areas at the bottom with the island insular ones in brown and the mainland rural in the purple. But we can see that the rural areas, actually looking at crude death rates, saw very little change from the late 19th century up to 1900. Whereas the urban areas, particularly the principal towns, saw major declines in their mortality from about 1870 to about 1890. We were interested in these differences, and in order to look at them more closely, we went to look at two communities, and we were given permission by the GROS to look at the actual death certificates and the birth certificates and the marriage certificates, but principally today we're interested in deaths, for the Isle of Skye and the town of Kilmarnock. Now, these pictures are more or less taken at the same time. And here we have Skye, a crofting community. The men are working with what looks like they're called cash chromes, wooden digging sticks, basically, working on the peat. They're collecting seaweed from the seashore. Many of the men would be away at sea. Whereas we compare that with Kilmarnock, where they've got multi-story buildings, electrified trams, lots of shops. Completely different, and yet both in the same country. So we were interested to compare and contrast the deaths and the mortality and what was killing people in these two settings. With the idea of what were we looking at when we looked at the deaths, the first thing that struck us when we compared the death certificates of Skye and Kilmarnock was the fact that on Skye, in the early years of our study, which was around about 1861, fewer than 20% of people dying had their deaths certified by a doctor. They were mainly reported, the cause of death was mainly reported by whoever informed the registrar that the death had occurred. So they were lay people, and they were describing what they thought had killed their relative. One of the other complications of this community is that they were describing it in Gaelic, but it was recorded in English. The Scottish records were always written in English, no matter whether they were actually reported in Gaelic or in English. So we have the added complication that they may be translations of what the registrar thought the person was saying in Gaelic and how it then mutated into English. Compare that with Kilmarnock, which is the purple line down here, where only with only 10% of the population were not having their deaths medically certified. And you can see as time goes on that by the 1900, virtually every death in Kilmarnock had a medical certification, whereas still around 50%, 40 to 50% of those in Skye, they were still not being reported by medical men. They weren't being certified by medical men. And the lines, the additional, where's my light gone, on this graph, indicate that Skye was not atypical of the island regions of Scotland in general. Come back, my mouse is gone. So insular regions also had about 50% in the late 1880s. Their deaths were not being certified medically. And the northern and northwestern areas, so the Argylls, the Sutherlands, the very remote areas, also were having far fewer of their deaths medically certified than was true of the urban areas and Scotland in general. So the way that deaths were reported in different regions of Scotland was going to have an impact on the kind of deaths that were being recorded and classified by the Registrar General. Now, did that matter? Did the lay people report different things from the medics? And the answer is definite yes. On Skye, where there were a large proportion of the deaths weren't recorded, it was a much more difficult thing to do for Kilmarnock because so many of them were recorded, medically certified. We can compare and contrast what doctors said and what lay people reported as causes of death. And the first thing to notice is that the number of unknown deaths in amongst the lay people is vast. Over 2,500 of the certificates that we had, cause unknown, they just didn't report a cause of death, or they said they didn't know what had caused it. Whereas doctors do not, or hardly ever, say that they don't know what killed somebody. They make it up if they don't know. At least that's what we interpret these figures to show. But doctors were much more prone to use certain terms than lay people. So they would report a death from phthisis, the doctors. They would report deaths from bronchitis. They would report deaths from pneumonia. And they would say that there were a person had a heart condition. But they were much less likely than the lay people to say that somebody died of old age or natural causes. And lay people were also much more likely to report that somebody died of asthma or of cold. We're not quite sure whether that means a cold or the cold, but what did he die of? Cold. And the other one that intrigued us was that lay people kept reporting that their children died of pleurisy, whereas doctors never reported that they're, well, hardly ever reported that somebody died of pleurisy. And when they did, they tended to be adults who were dying of pleurisy. And pleurisy is one of these things that apparently doctors today will tell you that it hurts. People have to report that they hurt across around their chests for them to begin to suspect that pleurisy was involved. And yet the lay people were saying that these infants, and they were under ages where they could talk, were reporting that these children had very painful lungs. It doesn't add up somehow. They were using a term that doctors just were not seeing when they visited patients. Just the 91 over here is because if somebody died suddenly, they were, like today, they were reported to the Procurator Fiscal and it was a legal process that had to be gone through before somebody could be declared dead from drowning. So drowning doesn't really equate with doctors or lay people. So it did matter whether or not the death was reported by a doctor or by a lay person. But when we began to think about it, the reasons why the deaths might be reported by a lay person rather than a doctor come into several categories. First of all, what medical knowledge, if any, did the lay person have? How quickly could a doctor be got? You're not going to get somebody registering a death, a doctor registering a death, if he can't get to see the patient. And in Skye, that was a major cause of non-certification, was the patient lived too far from where a doctor could be got quickly, and whether the person could afford to ask for the doctor to come and see the patient. And also whether or not they thought it was worth getting the doctor. It would seem that if your granny was 83, you didn't bother calling the doctor, nature would take its course. So very many elderly people did not see a doctor in their last illness. So all these factors influenced whether or not your death was certified by a doctor. If you had a working husband, you got the doctor because the husband was important to you and you would spend money to get him better. But if your mother or your father were ill, then you wouldn't. And if you were a small baby, you probably didn't either. Once we have got the causes of death onto the certificates, even then we find that there are problems in interpretation of what we're looking at. In the deaths that we see reported in Kilmarnock, we have 210 when we look at the Registrar General's report for Kilmarnock, which matches exactly the area that we have for our death certificates. The Registrar General reports that 210 deaths in the 1861 to 1901 period were due to maternal causes. They were related to childbirth. And this works out as a maternal mortality rate of about 55 per thousand. However, causes of death, as I said earlier, not only just of the one word like epilepsy, they don't necessarily say childbirth. They might say hemorrhage after childbirth. And the problem is that we're not quite sure how the clerks who are coding the causes of death have been taught to deal with that. Do they put that death under hemorrhage or under childbirth? And when we look at the death certificates that we have, we actually find 250, so an extra 40, where we have childbirth mentioned, but it obviously wasn't coded to the causes by the clerks to childbirth. It went into hemorrhage or some other classification. So even just looking at eyeballing the death certificates, we can increase maternal mortality to about 65 per thousand. Today, if we're looking at maternal deaths, we tend to look at a woman and whether or not she's had a birth in the last 6 weeks, and no matter what she dies of, we relate that to the fact that she's just given birth, and that is counted as maternal deaths. Now, if we do that with the deaths from Kilmarnock, we actually find an additional, that is on top of the 250 previous ones, an additional 188 where the woman died within 6 weeks of childbirth. So we, in our modern sense, would probably say that maternal mortality was 114 per thousand, not 55 per thousand. And therefore our story of how good maternal services were in Kilmarnock can change dramatically just by going and looking at additional information to go with the bald statement of fact on the certificates. This graph is supposed to, I don't know if it works, it's very small, I apologise. I couldn't fit 160 years comfortably on to a slide. Is that once we have the deaths and they're coded by the Registrar General, we have to take into account whether or not the classification schemes that was being used have changed. And in Scotland, across the 1855 to present day, we have had all these changes in classification. So when we're looking at cross history, we're looking at, I think it's 15, may have not counted right, different changes in classification, which may or may not affect the causes of death that we're looking at. So for the period that we're looking at today, we look at the classification which started off up until 1911. This arrow should be further up. The red arrow should extend further. It's a classification scheme that was devised and used by the Registrar General of Scotland, which very usefully does not match the one that was used by the Registrar General of England. So you have, if you want to compare across the borders, you have to do some even more mixing and matching. And then in 1911, not 1910 when it was first inaugurated, Scotland joined in the international classification, the international list of causes of death, and has followed that classification, so ICD-2 through to 10, to the present day. Now this means, of course, and many people in the audience know this much better than I do, that the way that a cause of death is reported changes across time. And here we're looking at respiratory tuberculosis from 1855 right through to 2010. And first of all, we have to debate what is actually meant by physis, because later on in the caste classification system, we suddenly become tuberculous physis, which suggests that there was different types of physis before that. So are all these deaths here in this classification necessarily tuberculous? We then get into pulmonary tuberculosis, which is being equated with phthisis, but is suggesting again that it's not quite the same thing. And then we add in additional things such as acute phthisis, and then later on into the 20th century we get laryngeal tuberculosis, tuberculosis of the respiratory system, and then this very small category down at the bottom, tuberculous pleurisy. So all of these things fit into the category respiratory tuberculosis, but we're not exactly sure whether they mean the same thing right across the span that we're looking at. This drop here in pleurisy, pleurisy in the brain, on phthisis is actually matched by a rise in pulmonary tuberculosis as medical, it would seem, medical terminology changed and doctors increasingly use that term. But if you didn't add back the pulmonary tuberculosis to the phthisis category, the drop would look quite dramatically different from how it would seem if you do add that cause into the whole picture. I told you I didn't like Alice's graphics, and I'm afraid this is one of hers. what she's done here is try to show the number of deaths by the categories, the classification system that the Registrar General of Scotland was using between 1855 and 1949. And you can see that, it's probably easier if I come over here, that while we have a sensible-ish story up to about 1890, it's suddenly cut by the classification changing from constitutional, developmental, infectious diseases, and lots of things being lumped into this one big category, general diseases, which then distorts the story across the 19th century, 20th century border. We have circulatory diseases here, you can see appears to have a large increase. Cancer appears as its own classification in the 1920s, having been in constitutional diseases and general diseases before that. So the system as generated by the statistics of the Registrar General is somewhat messy. As I just said, in his reports, both his general report and his detailed reports, the Registrar General of Scotland reported individual causes about, I think it's about 155 to start with, and no, 109, sorry, and then that grew to almost 300 by the 1949 period. And if we go back to those individual causes and reconstruct, we can get a much clearer picture than that classification picture allows. However, we're still dealing with patchworks, and this is another of Alice's beautiful not graphs. But her point here, and I think if I had been, I might have not called it heart disease, it's circulatory disease, in fact, because it starts off down here. In 1855, all your the causes that are being reported as circulatory deaths are apoplexy and heart disease. And then over time, you can see that cerebral hemorrhage and embolism and thrombosis emerge, if you like, out of apoplexy, and a great number of heart disease. It becomes more and more precise about what actually, what kind of heart disease. So you have heart failure, you have myocarditis, you have endocarditis, you have syncope, which in the beginning of the period simply means your heart stopped, so a lot of people died of that. But it was used as a classification by the Registrar General. So our picture of heart disease and circulatory disease is very much affected by these breaks in classification systems. However, it is possible, once you've spent quite a lot of time staring at it and gone cross-eyed, you can knit together the COSIs into new classifications. These are not the Registrar General's classifications. These are classifications we've applied and we think would stand up in modern-day terminology. I'd be happy to hear from the audience if they disagree. But these are numbers of deaths by category. So we have, down here we have tuberculosis, we have circulatory diseases in red, the ones that we've just looked at, neoplasms, cancers, we have infectious disease, diarrhea, respiratory diseases, and right at the top, because it's Scotland, we have violence. We thought we'd better put that one in there. But the one we would like you to look at here is old age. This does not appear in the Registrar General's categories at all. He doesn't publish statistics on those who died of old age. And yet it seems it has been a major cause, or a reported cause, of death in Scotland across the period that we've been looking at. You can see that the number of deaths appears to have risen from 1855 to about 1875, and then held relatively constant to 1915 before a downward-ish trajectory thereafter. Now, of course, again, to this audience, I don't really need to point out that the number of deaths have to be related to the population, and this is just Alice's memory point for me to remember that Scotland's population in blue was growing dramatically, pretty insistently, across the period we're looking at, whereas the deaths do not grow in such a dramatic fashion. And so when we actually look at mortality rates, we're not surprised to find that mortality declined from about 20 to 23 in the 1850s and 60s down to about 12-ish by 1945. We can see that infectious diseases virtually disappear, as does diarrhea. Neoplasms and circulatory disease increase, and old age tails away. It doesn't disappear completely, but even in 1945, people are reported as dying of old age. Respiratory diseases, too, are on the wane. And this picture kind of neatly encapsulates the picture that I have of the epidemiological transition, the infectious diseases, the diarrhea, the respiratory diseases waning away, the neoplasms and the circulatory diseases becoming a much bigger component. And this is certainly those very jaggedy graphs compared over decades. Now, we have to, of course, allow for the changing structure of the Scottish population, and just to bring that picture home to you, here are 1861, lovely classic pyramid shape. By 1901, the population in the working age groups is beginning to fill out, and by 1951, we're well on towards today's almost rectangular picture of population structure. And therefore, we have to adjust the causes that we just looked at to allow for these changing populations of structures of the population. And when we do that, compare the crude and the standardised death rates, we find that in the latter years of the 19th century, the crude death rates were actually lower than they should be, because there was a large proportion of the population now compared to earlier in the working age groups where mortality was low. And by the early years of the 20th century, the crude death rate was really too high, because the population was getting much older and all the deaths were being concentrated in those ages. So if we're looking at actual risk of dying from particular causes, standardised mortality rate hopefully will give you one of the best pictures. And while this doesn't change the overall picture that the unstandardised rates show, it does suggest that neoplasms and circulatory disease weren't actually as had such a big impact as they had when we looked at the crude population, because the population was getting older. Now, this is no different. This is the same graph, but just relayering it, so that we have neoplasms and circulatory diseases at the bottom, then respiratory and tuberculosis, so there's a kind of like causes are being sandwiched together. We have infectious diseases next to diarrhea, and on the other side of diarrhea, we have digestive diseases. We then have genitourinary disease and childbirth together next to perinatal. So the groups associated with sexual health and reproduction, really, if you like. There's the ill-defined category and then violence, which looks pretty constant at the top. The ill-defined category virtually disappears over the time, and here is the lay population are no longer reporting deaths. The proportion of the population that were living in the remote areas is much, much smaller. So and the medical services have spread across the country as well. All these factors impacting on the ill-defined causes. What interested us was that when Omran and the epidemiological transition were being discussed, and he was looking at the diseases of advanced societies, if you like, the circulatory diseases and the neoplasms, he didn't compare them with the causes that should have been in there. And over our period, we would argue, Alice has a very elaborate argument that I'm afraid I haven't memorised, so I'm not going to try. Maybe in discussion I could try and get it to the top front of my mouth. But basically, the point that she wanted to make was that... Oh, sorry, the mouse has disappeared again. When we look at old age, old age is a cause that very often is applied to diseases that are not easily recognisable. So you may die of heart failure, but unless you have an autopsy or you've had somebody doing an ECG on you, it won't be recognised as heart failure. And therefore, certainly in the 1850s and 60s, it was not classified as such. As is the same for the nervous system, these same kind of diseases there. Lots of the palsies and the paralyses that old people suffer from and the strokes may well be in these two categories at the bottom. And as they disappear, the circulatory and neoplasms diseases come up as causes. So we're kind of balancing one with the other. And the point that we're trying to make is that, in fact, those circulatory and neoplasms categories get bigger because previously the deaths that should have gone in them were in other categories, the old age and the nervous diseases. And therefore the circulatory diseases and the neoplasms that are supposedly characteristic of the developed diseases, the later stage of the epidemiological transition, aren't actually as new as the theorists would like us to believe, and that they were there in the historical register, they just haven't possibly been recognised to the extent that they deserve. Now, if you look, just to carry this idea a bit further forward, if we look at age-specific mortality rates and their causes, the causes that are killing the different age groups, we'll see that old people and these circulatory diseases are very closely tied. So here we have the history of age-specific mortality rates, and as you can see, the under ones, this very dark line here, nice and stable at about 130, 140 until 1900, and then impressive and steady decline thereafter, down to this era, just after the Second World War. The 1 to 4 is also a nice steady decline, just as we might expect. Whereas the over 75s, very high at 140, and hardly any decline until maybe just around the time of the Second World War. I'm sorry about the pinks, they don't do anything for me, but I hope you can see the lines that we're talking about. So if you look, again, these are our classifications built out of the individual causes reported by the Registrar General of Scotland. So across 1855 to 1949, infant mortality rates have been dominated by respiratory diseases, to some extent infectious diseases, and diarrhea, which has been a cause that inflicted lots of infants during the 19th century, and was also the major area of diarrhea deaths out of the whole population. And they were still a major cause of death by the 1940s. But you can see that perinatal deaths, those deaths occurring in the first month of life, probably to do with developmental diseases, congenital malformations and accidents at birth, was a major cause, even in the earliest period, although we suspect that a large number of the ill-defined deaths were also people. The baby died when it was born. People just said, we don't know why it died. So it was an ill-defined death. And that, the perinatal category grows as the ill-defined category diminishes. But by the middle of the 20th century, the vast majority of infant deaths were due to perinatal causes. And if we add in the 1 to 4s, we see a completely different profile across time. Here, infectious diseases are what kills the children. We can see interesting epidemics that could each individually be investigated. Diarrhea as a cause of death amongst the 1 to 4s virtually disappears after the First World War. And we can see the impact here of the 1918-19 flu epidemic as the respiratory diseases jump up. We'll come back to that just shortly. We have time. Here again is the 1918-19 flu epidemic. This is the causes for men aged 25 to 34. We can see that what kills people in this age group in Scotland is tuberculosis. And that the impact of the Second World War on tuberculosis, as well as violent deaths, was quite dramatic. We're not entirely clear. These are civilian men. You know, GROS always reported civilian deaths, not military deaths. So whether these violent deaths are men who came back from the front to die of wounds received, and whether those who developed tuberculosis in the trenches wherever they were in the war, were sent home to die from tuberculosis, again, we're not sure. But the Second World War stands out for these two causes and its impact on the population. Amongst women, the picture is rather different. Again, tuberculosis is killing large numbers and is still a major cause of death amongst women in this age group, even in the late 1940s. Childbirth, you can see this category, this sort of dun green category, has always been dangerous and was carrying off a considerable proportion of women. And again, to bring back that point that these are the ones that are reported as childbirth, there may be others that we're not certain about that could be added in. When we do this analysis using these various categories, we can see the impact of the influenza epidemic in 1918-19. This is all deaths. This whole picture is of respiratory diseases, which are bronchitis and pneumonia. Laryngitis and croup. Croup's very popular in Scotland. Lots of kids die from croup. And then a mishmash of other categories, which are other lung diseases. And the interesting thing, I think, is that influenza, the purple line, or the purple areas, is a relatively small component of the deaths of the 1918-19 flu epidemic. It was bronchitis, bronchopneumonia, and pneumonia that were put down as the major causes of death, as killing most people during that epidemic, which again brings back the point that you might have pneumonia after influenza. Bronchitis is a sequelae of influenza, and it's how the deaths were coded by the clerks, rather than what was actually happening on the ground and how the doctors recorded it, that influences our understanding and this profile of the major epidemic in 1918-19. Why bronchitis was on such an increase is a question that we would like to investigate further. We're not clear if this is a diagnostic impression or whether it's a description of a condition that doctors, as we saw earlier, lay people were reporting bronchitis. As more and more doctors came in the act, we see more and more pneumonia. And finally, just to come back to the idea of the older people, the degenerative diseases, the epidemiological transition. Here is where most of the greatest number of the greatest rate of death from these conditions applies, those of the over 55s. And if we drew a line across from 30 deaths per thousand, we'd see that it varies very little across the 1855 to 1949 period. And therefore, we would like to suggest that the epidemiological transition theory needs some tweaking. And we need to look much more carefully, go back and look at the English data, look at other countries' data to see just what categories the circulatory and neoplasms could have been being categorised earlier in the historic record, which has slightly warped our view of what happened over time. Finally, we'd like to, just in the last couple of minutes, if that's okay, just look at McEwen's theory about standard of living and whether or not it was changes in the standard of living that brought down mortality in Britain. McEwen's famous table, if you like, is this one, which shows you that 47% of the change in mortality could be ascribed to tuberculosis, and he very carefully puts all forms. We're not just looking at sizes or respiratory TB here. He then looks at typhus, scarlet fever, whooping cough, diphtheria, smallpox, and finally diarrhea and dysentery and cholera. And his argument went that as we couldn't allow various medical advances or epidemiological advances to explain the decline in TB over the late 19th century, then it must be due to food, standard of living, better nutrition, and this is why mortality fell, particularly tuberculosis fell in England and Wales. Later on, Flynn repeated the discussion and did the same calculations for Scotland, and you can see that the figures fit pretty well. Again, tuberculosis is by far and away the major change in mortality, and therefore he argued that McEwen's thesis held in Scotland. What is not immediately clear is that these figures are about the change from these specific causes. So McEwen said most of the change that took place across this time period was down to these causes. So let's look at the proportion of the causes, the proportion of the decline that each of these causes contributed. So out of those groups, tuberculosis looks as though it had the major impact on mortality decline. What we did was we went and using our categories that we had shown in previous slides, we said, well, we would like to do this comparison, but we don't want to take anything for granted. So we're going to look at all the decline that we see, not the bit from those specific diseases that McEwen picked out. And when we do that and we look at tuberculosis, the infectious diseases as a group, not as individual ones, as he did, respiratory diseases and diarrhea and all other change, we can see that, yes, indeed, tuberculosis did have an impact. It did have a considerable percentage of reduction of the standard mortality rate, over 20%, both across the 1870s to the 1900s and then the 1900s to the 1930s. But if we look at diarrhea, at least in Scotland, that has a bigger impact. And infectious diseases, when taken as a group, have an even bigger impact. And we can see that, again, it's actually other diseases in the 1900s to the 1930s. So we feel that McEwen has kind of oversold his story, and that if we look at this breakdown of causes of death, that we should be re-evaluating even the theories that McEwen has about what was actually reducing mortality. Here it looks, for example, as though public health and ways of keeping infectious disease from spreading across the communities had a rather bigger impact, not much bigger, but a bigger impact than the actual decrease in tuberculosis. And if those, if the infectious diseases are coming down and TB is considered to be an infectious disease, then aren't the measures that have been put in place and our understanding of infection and its how to control it, maybe they are having an impact on TB as much as food or standard of living. That's the end of the story that I'd like to tell you today, and I'd love to hear your feedback and your don't believe you, and please change Alice's colours on her graph. But just to finish off with, I'd like to mention the project that she, I, Chris and Lee are now involved in, which is called Digitising Scotland. And the idea is that the project will transcribe and computerise all the births, marriage and deaths records of Scotland. So all the information that I showed you on that original death certificate will be transcribed for every death in Scotland from 1855 right up to the present day. So you will have causes of death, we will have individual causes of death, which will be geo-referenced. You'll know exactly when they happened and where they happened. And we will be able to get into the causes of death as they were reported on the death certificates for a very long period of time, by region, by in urban or rural areas. And we'll be able to watch epidemics spread across the country. So hopefully in 3 to 5 years' time, this data will be available for the research community to get their hands on, and we'll be able to reinvestigate some of the theories such as Omran's epidemiological transition and McEwen's standard of living debate that I've touched on today. So thank you. I'm very happy to take questions.